Welcome to the Humanist Union of Madison, and a special welcome to our speaker, John Rummel, who is a school psychologist at Memorial High School and co-founder of Madison Skeptics, astrophotographer, and a proud humanist. So,
thanks, Bob. So Bob asked me a couple of months ago if I would be willing to lead a book discussion on Richard Dawkins' book. And I said that I'd be happy to. At that time, I hadn't seen the book yet. I had it pre-ordered because as soon as I heard Richard Dawkins was writing a children's book, I knew that I was really going to want to take a look at it and see what it is. So pulled a picture off the internet, which is the cover of the book, but it's not the cover of the one that I have, and it's not the cover of the ones that I see that you have either. So there might be...
It's a British edition.
Oh, that's the British edition. Okay, makes sense. So I got the book in the mail soon after the release date, and... read it with pleasure. I thought it was a great book, and I talked to several people here today who have also been looking at it, reading it, and people have had the same reaction. One of my first reactions was it wasn't what I was expecting at all. I was expecting sort of the, you know, like a children's book. I was expecting something aimed at elementary school kids, the nice large format, maybe 35, 40, 50 pages long, sort of like the Cat in the Hat, you know, for science geeks. And this weighs in at 270 pages, and it's 270 pages of what I found to be pretty dense text. It's not complicated stuff, but he presents a lot of really good science content, and I would say it's probably written with a typical maybe 13 or 14-year-old kid in mind. You know, educated, motivated kids, bright kids, it's probably going to go pretty much over the head of any but the most enthusiastic elementary school students. And I think it's a great book for adults, too, because I think that it's, again, it presents things pretty simply but not simplistically. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't know how many copies of the book would be available today. I knew I was going to bring one. I see we have at least, you know, two or three other ones floating around. So I would offer, you know, to pass them around if people want to take a look at it as we're talking. I did prepare some pictures just so that we could all, as I'm discussing something, we could all kind of look at some pictures at the same time. And so I do have a little bit of a, not a PowerPoint, but an Apple Keynote presentation. So I've never... really led a book discussion before, and I wasn't exactly sure how to proceed with a book discussion. I've written book reviews before, and I used to really enjoy reviewing books for primarily, I work with the Madison Astronomical Society, so I would review science books and astronomy books and write up, you know, a couple of hundred words, maybe a little bit more, maybe a little bit less in the form of reviews. So I wrote a review of this book, which was the best way that I could think of to sort of discipline myself when reading it. And so, you know, I could sit here and read a book review to you, which would be absurd, so I'm not going to do that. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to show some pictures of the book. I'm going to talk a little bit about who Richard Dawkins is and his background and just sort of how I see him coming to this point in his career, where he's writing a book aimed at children. And I think that's just kind of a really interesting concept in and of itself. And then maybe speculate a little bit about where Richard Dawkins is going after this, because I don't think Richard Dawkins is done popularizing science yet. So, see how well my remote control works? Richard Dawkins made his first splash with this book in 1976. The Selfish Gene was considered by many to be kind of a seminal work in evolutionary biology. And I read The Selfish Gene many years ago. It's been quite a long time since I read it, so I don't remember the book in detail well enough to know what he was doing. But the basic idea of the book was evolutionary biology and evolutionary psychology had this dilemma when it came to altruistic behavior, when it came to members within a species basically being nice to each other, because that couldn't really be explained very well by natural selection. If I'm nice to somebody or do something nice for somebody who's not related to me, and in the process I'm harmed and my associate somehow benefits, it doesn't benefit the passing on of my own genes. So what Dawkins did in this book is he reconceptualized evolution from the standpoint of the gene rather than from the standpoint of the organism. And there's a lot more to it than that, but it's an interesting idea, and it allowed a lot of people to sort of reconceptualize how they were thinking about evolution, how they were thinking about natural selection. And it basically, it was one of those ideas that just had a lot of explanatory power beyond what Dawkins initially saw, and it kind of, and I'm not a biologist, so I can't say this for sure, but it kind of was like a little mini revolution within the field. A lot of people really liked the ideas of this young evolutionary biologist from Oxford who just kind of came on the scene with this book. So The Selfish Gene was 1976. Dawkins followed it up with a number of other books. The Extended Phenotype, which came out 6 years later, was a book where he answered a lot of the criticisms that were kind of spurred on by The Selfish Gene. So that was kind of a sequel or an extension of The Selfish Gene. And then The Blind Watchmaker and Rivers Out of Eden. I read The Blind Watchmaker years ago. I don't think I've ever read Rivers Out of Eden. So I characterize much of the rest of Dawkins' writing career as being books where he kind of lit up with his passion to explain to a popular audience what exactly evolution is and how natural selection works. And certainly in Climbing Mount Improbable, which was the first Dawkins book that I ever read, Climbing Mount Improbable was, I believe, written as an answer to the wave of creationism that kind of exploded in the 1980s and 1990s and got a lot of traction with a lot of school boards and a lot of states enacting policies where there was supposed to be some kind of equal time. And you know, all of this was eventually struck down by a couple of Supreme Court decisions. But there was a lot, and as you know today, even today, polls conducted of the American citizenry today still show an astoundingly high number of people who endorse what essentially is young Earth creationist viewpoints. And so Richard Dawkins, as a Brit, was, you know, aghast at this. And so he was writing a lot of his books aimed at really explaining what natural selection is. And Climbing Mount Improbable is really just one great argument in favor of, you know, the old creationist canard that if a tornado hits a junkyard, it's not going to leave a 747 behind. You know, you can't get organization out of chaos. And Richard Dawkins would agree with that assessment that a tornado is not going to leave a 747 fully assembled after it goes through a junkyard. But the improbability is associated with the appearance of design in life. As improbable as it is exactly what natural selection does. And natural selection is the designer in previous books, going back to some of his previous books where he just gets to the same idea, explaining evolution and natural selection in a really, really accessible way. And Dawkins' books, The Selfish Gene, I think, has sold over 1 million copies, been translated into many languages. I didn't look up how his other books have done. He's done well. He's obviously made some money. He's obviously made a name for himself in the publishing world. He's one of the most popularizers of science that we have today. But many people would have never probably heard of Richard Dawkins if it hadn't been for his next book. And I can't find a way. Richard, I don't know if you're in my way or not. How about maybe if I give this to you, in your proximity. Do you know how to use these?
No, I don't.
That right button, this little ring, that is the button. If you just aim it behind you and press, it should advance. There we go. So if it hadn't been for this book, I'm guessing that a lot of people probably never would have heard of Richard Dawkins. The God Delusion, published in 2006, outsold, I think, most of his other books combined. It's currently sold over 2 million copies. It's been translated into 30 languages. It was on the New York Times bestseller list for something like 60 weeks or something like that. Just an astoundingly powerful book that really kicked off a national discussion. Along with his sort of compatriot authors, the so-named Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, and Daniel Dennett. Dawkins is one of the Four Horsemen. All of these guys, I think Sam Harris was first out of the gate with The End of Faith in the early 2000s, But these four writers, and I think Dawkins is probably the biggest name among them, just in terms of name recognition, all of a sudden put atheism kind of out there in the front lines of the discussion in our culture. And Richard Dawkins in this book, if you've read it, you know that he makes a strong push for people who are closet atheists to go ahead and come out of the closet, because that's how consciousness raising takes place. Atheists are still regarded as the least trusted segment of society in polls that phrase the question, would you vote for a blank for president? And you fill in the blank with words like woman, Jew, other minorities, other religious affiliations. Atheist is the word that receives the lowest endorsement from the public. Something like 18% of the public say they would in fact vote for an atheist, whereas Jews and Mormons are now well up into the 70s, 80s, and 90s. So Dawkins really was going after the idea that atheism is, you know, we should be proud to be atheists. There is intellectual satisfaction, and certainly there's a lot that atheists can benefit society by fighting against some of the dogmatic practices of organized religion and so forth and so on. Anyway, the God delusion is what kind of put Dawkins on the map, I think. That was now about 5 years ago. Click. He followed that up 2 years ago with The Greatest Show on Earth, which is a book that is all about presenting the evidences for evolution. So he got the atheism thing out of his system. Well, no, he really didn't. He still has that, you know, bug up his butt. But this book was definitely back to the science of evolution, really presenting in one book just a wonderful, wonderful presentation of all the different lines of evidence from all the different disciplines that show why evolution is accepted by 99.9% of the scientific public, the scientific establishment. In this book, he also is, in many parts of this book, he's still responding to the creationist threat. And so he doesn't take shots necessarily. He doesn't argue directly against the creationist or intelligent design movements, but he mentions them many times in this book when he's presenting counter arguments to areas where they have really made inroads into how the public thinks about science. So this was his most recent book, and it was just last year that I heard he was writing a new book, and I heard it was going to be a book for children, and I was expecting again to have a children's book. So go ahead and take us on to the next one. It's just a picture of the magic of reality. And I didn't read a lot of the pre-press. I just kind of, you know, I pre-ordered my copy. I knew I would get it in October when it was finally released, and so I was just waiting for it to come. Then Bob contacted me about doing a book discussion, which I thought was a great idea. So I got mine a couple, 3 weeks ago. And I think the next several slides now, so we're gonna just roll through these kind of quickly. I'll go back one to the table of contents. So it's still hard to read, but this book is organized into 12 chapters, and each chapter basically asks a question. And this is a question, obviously, that Richard Dawkins felt would be kind of a way to organize some major topics in science. And so you can see that he doesn't stay within his own field of biology. He covers a lot of interesting areas of science, but I found, not surprisingly, when he writes about biology, when he writes about evolution and natural selection, there's a twinkle in his eye that, figuratively speaking, that's probably not there as opposed to when he's writing about cosmology or astronomy or something like that. He's a wonderful writer. He's a wonderful presenter of science, but he knows what his field is, and he does write quite a lot about evolution, particularly in the first chapter and the second chapter. So the first chapter, what is reality, what is magic? Dawkins just, you know, spends a little bit of time talking about, a lot of pages, a lot of words. This is not a simplified book. Talking about how we know what's really true. He talks about the nature of scientific investigation. He talks about the scientific method. He talks about how scientists no things, quote unquote, no things are true. Even in an example, when we're talking about something like a bacteria. Have you ever seen a bacteria? You know, bacteria, by their definition, are microscopic. They're invisible to the naked eye. So how can we know about the truth of something when we can't see it? So he talks about how we can use instrumentation to magnify our vision, to make large, to make small things large, or in the case of galaxies and quasars, to make distant, faint things brighter and seem closer. So we use instrumentation to augment our view, and science has a way, indeed, of determining the truth of something by the process of the scientific method, scientific investigation. So he spends a lot of time talking about that. He talks about magic. Go ahead and let's move forward to just talking about, this is the first page of his chapter one, and you can see the rich use of illustration. I had never heard of Dave McKean before, but Dave McKean has evidently got quite a lineage and quite a pedigree as far as his work in illustrating other major works. The book is littered with, every single page has illustrations. Every single page has beautiful illustrations, and they're illustrations that are directly related to the content. So it's I think, a wonderful job illustrating the book. I was talking with somebody when I first came in today that found that some of the illustrations are almost so good that they were even a little bit distracting. And some of the time he does use, the illustrations will dominate the page to the point that he uses white text on black background, which some people find difficult to read. Mm-hmm. But it's really, it's a wonderful book. And I said in my book review that when I was a kid, I remember having a set of science books that were about the same size as this. It was a 4-volume set. And I looked online to see if I could find some information about this, because obviously the books are long gone. But a 4-volume set of science books that were written much in this way, and they covered everything. And I was probably 12 or 13 when I had these books, or maybe even younger. But I vividly remember reading about earthquakes and volcanoes and great telescopes and space travel and time travel and just all of these incredibly interesting topics in a format that was illustrated like this. And when I first opened up Dawkins' book, it made me feel like that 13-year-old kid reading a really engaging science book. And I just felt like, wow, this is a book that I think is going to do its job well, because it's well written, well illustrated, and written by somebody who knows what he's doing. So, go ahead. This is, I believe it's from that first chapter, although now I forget exactly where I got it. But these two quotes, I think, summarize exactly what Dawkins is trying to do in this book. And so I'll insult you by reading to you. "The whole history of science shows us that things once thought to be the result of the supernatural, caused by gods, both happy and angry, demons, witches, spirits, curses, and spells, actually do have natural explanations. Explanations that we can understand and test and have confidence in." And go on to the next one. "There is absolutely no reason to believe that those things for which science does not yet have natural explanations will turn out to be supernatural, of supernatural origin, any more than volcanoes or earthquakes or diseases turn out to be caused by angry deities, as people once believed they were." So he organizes this book for each one of those questions. The introductory chapter isn't really a question, but then each one of the chapters has this question to sort of anchor it in the subject matter. He opens the chapter in discussing what did people used to think. And so the second chapter is, go ahead and hit the second one. This is just more random pictures of his artwork. You recognize the characters there on the right-hand page?
And your left.
Yeah, Pendulet at the bottom, and Teller, I think, is
at the top.
Although
way at the top.
Yeah, hanging down there. He makes generous use of his colleagues in skepticism and magic, including Penn and Teller. James Randi makes some appearances in the illustrations. He talks about magic in the title of the book, and the different ways that we use the term magic, from the magic of the supernatural to the magic of really understanding how something works. And he talks about sort of the emotional level, how people can be transported by really understanding something. So go ahead and continue to the next. So this is the second chapter. And this is the first, that's organized around a central question. Who was the first person? So every chapter starts out with an exploration into the mythology and legend. How did people answer this question 2,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago? How did people answer this question 300 or 400 years ago? And then after he discusses, maybe in the first 3, 4, 5 pages of each chapter, a beautiful survey of the history of mythology and legend, then he goes to, I think it's the next slide. This is just some of the illustrations as he talks about the various cultures as they approach this question. Continue. He'll come to a subheading in this chapter, who is the first person really? And now he engages in what have we learned about how to approach this question from a scientific standpoint. And I'm going to use this chapter as just sort of, I'm going to take you through most of this chapter because this is a really good chapter to illustrate what he's doing with this book. And there's a lot of biology, evolution, and natural selection, obviously, in how we answer this question. And so one of the things that he starts off with is this idea of gradual change. And he's talked about this in other books that he's written, and many, many other writers have also tried to communicate, apropos of a discussion of evolution, just how important this concept of gradual change is. And so Dawkins challenges us to do a thought experiment. And you see the young man in the illustration there at the bottom right holding a photograph of a person. Dawkins says, imagine you take a photograph of a person every day of his life. And I'll use him because the pictures are showing the pictures of a man. If you take a picture of a person every day of their life, thousands and thousands of pictures, and then you take the picture from Thursday, October 4th, and compare it carefully with the picture that was taken on Wednesday, October 3rd. For all intents and purposes, the pictures are going to be very, very similar. Maybe different clothing, maybe a different facial expression, but there's going to be very little change. But if you start to imagine that sequence of pictures, you know, one from every day of that person's life, if you compare the picture taken on Thursday, October 4th this year with Thursday, October 4th last year, now you'll see some substantial changes. And if you compare a picture taken this year with a picture taken a decade ago, you'll see even more changes. So this idea of gradual change that accumulates over time is illustrated using his little thought experiment of a picture taken of a person every day. So then he modifies the model a little bit. Let's imagine that you have a picture of you, Richard. And then we have a picture taken of your father when he was approximately your age, of your grandfather when he was approximately your age, and extend that metaphor into the past. And obviously we get to, you know, before too many dozen generations have gone by, you know, we're before the age of cameras. And so it's a thought experiment, he says. And so he has in his illustrations the kid standing there with a stack of photographs in the center, and then over at the right, maybe comparing a photograph of his father with a photograph taken of his grandfather. And as you talk about each individual picture, one generation removed, two generation removed, again, the differences are going to be subtle. Now, you're not going to look as much like your grandfather or your father as you'll look like a picture of you taken last year. But the similarity is that we're looking at pictures of human beings, of male human beings, is obvious. So go to the next slide. So as he discusses in his text this idea of this thought experiment, every page now continues on the metaphor of the pictures, the stack of thousands and thousands of pictures going back to your father, your grandfather, your great-grandfather, your great-great-grandfather, your third and fourth, fifth generation grandfathers. And then he imagines you pulling, after you get to 50,000 great-grandfathers ago, you pull out the picture. Now you've got somebody who still is demonstrably human, but you know, it looks very different than my grandfather looked. And if you pull out one a little bit farther back, you know, so on, you know, the differences do slowly accumulate over time. So I think the one on the left is the 4,000 greats grandfather, as Dawkins labels them, and then the 50,000th greats grandfather, as you're getting back to some significant, you know, percentage of the way back in the development of humans from our common ancestors with chimpanzees. So go on to the next one. And this is just now successive pages. So he's discussing the implications of this model, but I love the fact that along the bottom is that stack of photographs that just keeps on winding back in time, thousands and thousands of photographs. And this is what I mean about, you know, the inventiveness of the illustrations. The illustrations are painting a visual picture to go along with the verbal picture that Dawkins is explaining. And I think it's just very effective. So you can imagine just going in there and just selectively pulling out another one and taking a look, and pulling out another one and taking a look as you go hundreds of thousands of generations back in time. Because, of course, what are you eventually going to start to see if you have a picture of every successive generation going back 100,000, 200,000 generations? So Richard, to the next. And he's talking about fossils here. And now he's talking about a ride back in time, and the pictures just continue their march along the bottom of the page. Thousands of pictures. One more. And here he's pulling out a couple of the pictures, and now you're seeing that at the 250,000th great-grandfather on that left illustration, and again, it's so dark, I apologize for that, but clearly a, you know, some kind of a simian ancestor. And then, you know, the one in the middle, the 1,500,000th great-grandfather, and then getting over to the, you know, we're back into early mammals now, that the idea that humans did slowly evolve over a process of very, very gradual change, generation by generation. And in the text, he'll discuss things like, you know, our modern concept of speciation, where we have books that sort of neatly group animals into clear categories that, you know, this species versus this species versus this species, you know, it breaks down when you think about it on the level of generation by generation, just the same way if you're trying to take, you know, the pictures of the child and answer the question, when did the infant become the toddler? At what point? And you're looking at a picture every day, you know, where do you draw that line? No longer an infant, but now a toddler. Clearly, you can't do that. It's a very kind of a vague, fuzzy line. We all are very comfortable looking at that child saying, well, that's a toddler. But the actual boundary line between toddlerhood and infancy, when you look at the level of, you know, picture by picture, is tough to make. Much as the same way, you know, we talk about when did the earliest ancestor of the first human being, where, well, clearly there was no event where a human was born to a simian ancestor. It was a gradual progress that when you add it up over the millions of years that evolution has been working on us and our ancestors, you know, it's fairly clear. Go back one more. And I think he ends the chapter now, and we're looking at clearly, you know, pre-simian, even pre-mammal. We're back into some reptilian ancestors, and I think that's 170 millionth great-grandfather, so 170 million generations. And one more, and I believe this is the last page in that chapter. Whoops, oh no, now he, still, the photos are speeding across the bottom of the page, so that metaphor is still holding, and now he's talking about DNA, and how the those three lines of the DNA base pairs are comparing, I think, a human with a mouse with something else, just showing the similarities of the DNA base pairs. When you compare us to some of our related species on the level of the genome, you know, we're remarkably similar with a few changes in lettering, and of course, the further back you go, or the more you deviate away from our closest relatives, the more that the DNA deviates as well. One more. And I think we get to now, he shows, you pull out this picture, and at 185 million generations ago, about 417 million years, is the creature which I think is based upon the transitional form Tiktaalik, which was discovered about 4 or 5 years ago by Neil Shubin at the University of Chicago. And so this is basically the end of that chapter. Who was the first person, really? And of course, the answer to that question is there really wasn't the first person, because the gradual change from human type to whatever preceded humans was so gradual that it would have been unnoticeable to anybody who was trying to identify, you know, where do you draw the line? So this is just an illustration through one chapter of what Dawkins does throughout the book in other discipline areas besides biology. But again, I think Dawkins is probably at his best, and he's certainly at his most passionate when he's writing about what he knows best, and that's evolution. So now, I'm just going to have you press, because I think that The next couple of ones are just illustrations of different aspects of his artwork. So let's go ahead and go. This is from the chapter, I believe, on what is stuff made of or something like that, where he's talking about, actually I'm not positive now, I think it's pretty sequential, but I took a picture of this one because he's got the little illustration of the atom there on the right hand page, and the atom is embedded in the text and you can see how it's distorting the text around. It just does little things like that that I think are cool. You know, I think of that when I think of like what a black hole does to matter around it, but you know, this is an atom. And again, I believe he's talking in this chapter about, the world on the molecular and the atomic level, the unseen, what is stuff made of, and that kind of stuff. So go ahead and... what really changes day to night in winter and summer? I think it's chapter 4 or 5, talking about, you know, what causes day and night and what causes the seasons. A great basic science question. And also... When you talk about the seasons, one of the most misunderstood science concepts, even among college graduates, you ask people why we have winter and summer, people have an amazingly hard time really explaining why our planet experiences seasons. It's not as obvious as some people think it is, and it's a great discussion. But I also use this as an example of when Dawkins organized his book around 12 chapters, 11 provocative questions, he kind of gave himself those 11 categories to deal with. And I think that he had to then shoehorn some other things that he probably wanted to talk about into those. And so some of the chapters felt like they had material added to them that just felt a little bit out of place. And I give one example from this chapter. So if you go forward, he's talking about the seasons. And so there he's introduced the idea that, you know, as the Earth orbits around the sun, we have distinct seasons in there. So along the top you see the tree exemplifying the four seasons of the year, spring, summer, winter, and fall, or spring, summer, fall, and winter. He talks about the tilt of the earth. We'll get to an illustration on that. But I like the fact that he put the upside down trees at the bottom because he's also discussing that the seasons are opposite in the northern and southern hemispheres. And a simple model which would be based upon the distance of the earth to the sun, which is what a lot of people would first, you know, hazard as a guess to this question, couldn't address why is it winter in Wisconsin when it's summer in Australia. And so, you know, he talks about that. And again, the nice use of the upside down illustration. Go ahead, one more, Richard. This is where he introduces the idea of orbits, because you're talking about the Earth orbiting the sun. Clearly, you have to understand what an orbit is. And so he spends a page duplicating the classic illustration that Isaac Newton used in the Principia of the cannon firing a cannonball that is fired with enough force that it lands, you know, maybe a half a continent away. And if you fire it with a little bit more force, it travels maybe a whole continent away. And Newton used this to illustrate the concept of orbits, that if you fire the cannonball with enough force, that as it begins to fall back to Earth, the curvature of the Earth curving away from the fall, eventually with enough force, the cannonball would go all the way around the Earth. And that's, of course, what an orbit is. And he talks in this section a lot about what weightlessness is. Weightlessness is really just free fall. But I put this in here as an illustration. This is a great science concept that, you know, probably deserves to have a section of its own. But because Dawkins didn't have a chapter entitled, "Why Are Things Weightless in Space?" which is where this would have naturally gone, he inserts this discussion in the middle of his chapter on why do we have day and night and why do we have the seasons. And obviously it's related, obviously it's appropriate, but I can just picture, you know, a kid or an adult or anybody, you know, immersing themselves in a really great discussion of this with the great graphics and like, you know, where were we? You know, talking about night and day? But, you know, it's not bad. It's just like there's so much stuff that he wanted to use and so much stuff that he wanted to present that occasionally there's this like interlude where you think, you know, maybe you could have broken it up into some smaller questions or had smaller chapters or I don't know, something like that. I'm not criticizing him as much as I'm saying that, you know, it felt a little awkward, but it still works very effectively. Let's go and see what's next. Continuing in that chapter, now he's talking about spacecraft, visiting other planets. There's the Cassini mission, and you can see the way that the the line that represents the path of the spacecraft bends around Jupiter. He's talking about gravity assists. Mm. Again, in a chapter dedicated to why is there day and night, he just couldn't resist. You know, there's so much interesting stuff to talk about here. This was the place where it belonged, and so he put it there. But again, beautiful illustrations. There's the white text on black background that we were talking about that can be difficult to read even when it's not a fuzzy photograph. Mm-hmm. Keep going. And so here's where he, you know, presents the classic illustration for the axial tilt of the Earth and describes in other pictures in, you know, this chapter that I didn't show, just a great, great, straightforward explanation of why we have seasons. And I don't think I didn't exhaustively take pictures of the whole chapter. The books are here. But that's his approach. And even when he's outside of his field of biology, his science is very accurate. His explanations are very appropriate. And again, I think it's going to make a lot of people happy, anywhere from that elementary school bright kid to typical middle school kids, all the way up to grown-ups like us. This is his chapter on what are things made of. This is chapter 4, what are things made of? And this is where he talks about the world on the cellular level and the world on the level of atoms and even smaller particles than atoms. And he makes the observation at the end of this chapter that this is the only chapter that does not start off with mythology and legend. This is the only chapter which doesn't delve into a discussion of, in ancient times, what did people think things were made of. He discusses a little bit of the ancient Greeks who had the idea of atoms, that there must be some component of matter, which when you keep on dividing it, you get down to some indivisible something. And so I think it was Democritus, somebody who knew about, hypothesized about atoms. But he makes the observation at the end of this chapter that, you know, there aren't any legends and mythology about this because people didn't know about cells. People didn't know about microscopic organisms. And somewhere in this chapter, go ahead and see what's next. This is moving on to another chapter. In the chapter on what are things made of, he has a wonderful photograph. Well, it's not a photograph. It's one of Dave McKean's illustrations of dust mites. And it's an illustration of dust mites as you might see them if you were even smaller than the dust mite and you were looking up at these enormously scary creatures. Can you imagine what mythologies would have grown up if ancient people had ever seen a dust mite from, you know, there would be no shortage of wonderful stories about monsters and dragons or whatever if dust mites had been known. But nobody had ever seen a dust mite until the invention of the microscope in the 17th century. And moving on to sort of, you know, what we're going to talk about next in Dawkins' presentation is he makes the observation in a very innocuous and very friendly way that certain cultures invented stories to explain why things happen. That's what mythology is, after all. But if there really was a God who authored the Bible, why was all this invisible stuff left out? You know, certainly God would have known about dust mites, or God would have known about, you know. And so, again, Dawkins doesn't take a direct jab at religious dogma here, but he, in his discussion, he clearly addresses the question that isn't it interesting that there is no mythological or Judeo-Christian or other, you know, religious tradition that addresses something like that, that just clearly couldn't have been known until instrumentation was invented in order to make the invisible visible, and he makes that observation. So moving on to another chapter, chapter 11, why do bad things happen? And this is obviously a chapter where you can get into a lot of theological discussion, and in his discussion of the mythology and the legends, he addresses that, he discusses that head on. But then he gets into, and I don't know if I have a picture of it, I don't. Well, you know, he comes to the why do bad things really happen? And it just, you know, gives him a great opportunity to talk about things like, and he doesn't use the terminology that I'll use, but, you know, the whole confirmation bias thing that, you know, when people look at a situation like a tornado destroying a town in Missouri, mm-hmm. you know, it's easy to focus on the quote-unquote miraculous, that this child was saved, you know, in the midst of all this destruction. But what, you know, what they don't report in the same, you know, news story that may have been written by somebody with a particular religious bent is that hundreds of people lost their homes or died agonizing deaths, and yet this one child was saved. That it's easy to look at a situation and see what you want to see. He talks about luck. He talks about the statistics of luck. He talks about the fact that things happen all the time. 1,000 things just happened in this room while we've been talking. The door just opened. You know, thousands of things happen every moment. Thousands of things happen in culture and in the news every day. And we tend to isolate on the ones that we think have meaning or the ones that are somewhat emotionally charged. And Dawkins talks about the fact that bad things only look bad if you have a particular perspective. And so he uses this chapter again. He's not preaching against religion. He's not taking any kind of a pro or con stance toward any dogma other than how do we really know what's true? And for that, he presents the scientific method. He does a great job of distinguishing between what is real versus what is imaginary or what is supernatural. He does a lot of talking about supernatural versus natural in terms of the scientific method. The big question that I had when I was reading this book is how was he going to address the topic of God and religion? And I think he really does it by, first of all, not differentiating any mythology from any other mythology. So in other words, the Judeo-Christian tradition is presented as simply one of the options. And there are thousands of mythological and legendary traditions. Judeo-Christian tradition is simply one of those. And so he'll talk about the story of Noah and the Ark. And in the same sentence, he'll immediately point out that the story of Noah as presented in the first five books of the Bible was, you know, one of many, many, many stories. And it wasn't even the first one of civilization being destroyed by a great flood and a boat being built to save the select few. So he doesn't treat Christianity with any respect different than he accords it to any other mythology or legend. And he draws the distinction in all cases of, you know, as opposed to the modern view or the scientific view. He was accused in the God delusion of being shrill or being confrontational or being any of 1,000 other adjectives that are synonymous with attack dog. And I personally don't think that's true. I don't think he pulled any punches, and I think that he was very, very aggressive in calling out religion for what it needs to be called out for. But in this book, he doesn't take that approach at all. In fact, this book, the chapters where he really addresses it, like a couple of, you know, scattered throughout the book, he just does it in such a, it's hard for me to describe exactly what I mean by this. Not offensive, although I can only speak for myself that, you know, I likely wouldn't be offended even if he had been a little bit more aggressive. But not playing favoritism and not necessarily singling out any particular tradition for special treatment. It's all put on the level of pre-Age of Enlightenment mythological thinking. And that's kind of where it rests. And it doesn't come across as being offensive because it's a science book. And I think I've talked for long enough. That's my impression. That's how it struck me. I'm really curious to hear from those of you who have read it what you think or what struck you about the book that might be different than my take.
Has anybody read any significant part of the book?
I've read the beginning chapters. I kind of agree with what you said, John, is that he doesn't single out Christianity. It's just kind of blended in with everything else. When he talks about the kangaroo people, it's this first man. It's the same story, and if you want to extrapolate that into Adam, the first man, I mean, he does that whole thing where you can't, magic is where you turn a frog into a prince, and that doesn't happen, or something. That's magic where, you know, maybe a magician can do that and make you think that that's what they're saying. And then he does the whole Cinderella with a pumpkin into a coach thing. Which I think is kind of interesting for children, because children live on that kind of fantasy kind of thing where something magically can happen to something else. And basically the whole idea that man just magically appeared doesn't follow with what we actually know about, you know, science and that type of things.
Right.
But I thought that he's been on a lot of talk shows discussing this book, and he's made it very clear that he's not this is not an anti-religion book. Some people beg to differ with that, with him, but he definitely includes Christianity in the mythical realm, and I think he does a really good job of that, just including it. He doesn't single it out, but he just kind of, I think he leaves it kind of to the reader to extrapolate that it's myth on their own. That's what I think his goal was.
Yeah.
Let you decide. You know, I'm giving you the components here, and you're going to take them and make and understand what that means.
Yeah, I feel that's kind of what I was trying to get at. Laying it all out in such a way that it's done very objectively, very factually, without necessarily trying to draw a conclusion in anybody's mind. It's all mythology. It's all, and again, he doesn't say this, it's all kind of that childish way of looking at things, the way we used to look at things before we knew enough to look at it any differently. And it's perfectly understandable that we had stories like that. But, you know, that in that first or second chapter where he talks about the frog into a prince or the pumpkin into a coach and those kinds of things, clearly examples of magical storytelling that he then says, you know, that's a modern legend. That's, you know, written by an author, you know, a couple of hundred years ago as to something that was written a couple of thousand years ago. But it's all magic. What is it really? You know, what is the real explanation for where the first person came from? And then he goes into the beautiful discussion of the science of that question. So it's absolutely, I haven't seen the interviews that you're referring to, but I can imagine what people are saying, because they still have the God delusion firmly entrenched in their minds, and they believe that anything Richard Dawkins does or says now is a full frontal attack on religion. And it's not. And his book, The Greatest Show on Earth, was criticized on the same basis, that he was attacking Christian believers because of their belief in creationism. And that's not what he was doing with that book, but he was accused of doing that because the memory of the God delusion was so large in people's minds.
People come in with a kind of a chip on their shoulder, I think, when they read his material. And I mean, I hear that from atheists too, but he's not helping the cause.
Yeah.
And like, you know, I just find that whole idea to be rather humorous, that that somebody can't speak out and actually say what's the truth, and they get criticized for it.
Yeah.
And, in a way, it's extremely clever, that magic talk, because he starts with the supernatural magic, but then there's this section on the pumpkin into the coach. He goes into it almost in a scientific talk, in a sort of way as how many pieces of the coach that you need to have a coach, and how much this magic would be to get this coach from a pumpkin, to get all these pieces, and they sort of throw it together in a bag, and then she'd have to figure out how to put all the pieces of the transformed pumpkin into a coach, which sort of makes it even more laughable for sort of neophyte reading it.
Yeah.
And then he transposes exactly into the looking up at the night sky and just saying, oh my gosh, how beautiful and magical it is to see that beautiful night sky. So the way he was talking, that's so clever. He makes a great deal of fun over the pumpkin of the coach thing, but then he goes into the night sky and the beauty of the night sky, and just sort of the way it's written, it makes fun of the supernatural magic, but says the real beauty is in the science of the cosmos.
Yeah, that's an undercurrent of the book is, and he's written about this before, like the whole premise of the unweaving of the rainbow was, you know, the criticism that had been leveled against scientists in general, maybe against Isaac Newton, although I can't remember, that by explaining the optics and the science and the physics of optics, you've taken all the magic out of the rainbow. Richard Feynman talked about this too. He said, no, science hasn't done any such thing. By really understanding, you know, the actual science of optics, that adds to our understanding and our appreciation of the rainbow. So he does, you know, he talks about magic, distinguishing, you know, the belief in supernatural from the magic as we use the term to describe just the satisfaction or the intellectual, emotional fulfillment when we truly understand how something works and we truly understand how something happens.
I have to say that some of those writings do come off as lose the magic of this, even of the science sometimes. Richard Dawkins' other writings. So I really appreciated this book that he really tried to show the magic of science and the world around. In this book. I think that's what he was really trying to aim for in this book. He was talking about scattering all over the place, but I think he's sort of saying he loves the science out there and it's really nice and neat and wonderful and all that. So, I mean, for the preteens who get dosed with whether watching our commercials on television, you know what that's like. For the preteen who sees that and then reads a book like this, it's just like, oh, so refreshing. That's my opinion.
Yeah.
One of the criticisms you had about the edit, I thought it needed better editing, more so than what he was saying. I just thought his editing, or whoever did the editing for it, needed to have a little, maybe they were afraid to actually edit Richard Dawkins, I don't know, but I thought some of it was kind of like, you know, you're reading it and you're like, wait a minute, you know, you have to kind of, you're making the shift that it's not a smooth transition or something where, you know, he kind of goes off on some area, like you said, where, you know, if they'd have edited that into a different thing, it would have flowed better. But that might be just for adults that we see that more. I was kind of surprised by the book because I looked at, when I started reading it, I thought, this isn't really a book for children. I mean, I was kind of confused by what his target audience was. I mean, what age bracket did he think this was going to be for?
I think the preteen team as well.
Yeah. But I'm on Facebook a lot, and I'm on a Mothers Beyond Belief page, and people were asking about the book and if anybody had read it and they want to buy it for Christmas for their children. And there's people are buying it for 6-year-olds,
yeah.
And I'm like, well, they might be really intrigued by the illustrations in it, but the writing. Some people are reading it to their kids, and they seem to all be liking it and enjoying it and stuff.
Kids would enjoy this maybe.
But yeah, I mean I think there's parts of it that are, but I mean some of it, he gets into pretty. There's a lot of detail in it, but I think a lot of kids are just not going to be able to grasp, unless they are like 13 or 14 years old.
Yeah, I'm trying to think about those young kids and thinking about my own experience when I was a kid, because I knew that I read books that were over my head.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, a motivated person reading a book, even us, if I pick up like, you know, the latest book by Stephen Hawking, you know, I'll read for what I can appreciate, and I'll skip over the stuff that I know I'm just not going to get. And I think that a lot of kids will do that too. They'll latch on to the illustrations are great. Mm-hmm. A lot of the storytelling, mythology, recounting is great. And then a lot of the science, I got that. You know, skip over that, get that, skip over that. It's the kind of book that you can almost open up and dip into it anywhere. You don't have to read it from front to back. Mm-hmm. You don't even have to read the chapters from front to back if you don't want to, because there's just so much, like, you know, to dip into and be engaged at any point. Like, you know, you could get a lot of that discussion of orbital mechanics without ever knowing that you're in the middle of a chapter on why is day and night the way it is, or why do the seasons work the way they are. So I think it will appeal to a broad range, but I think it's clearly not written for the audience that I first thought it was written for, which is the younger kids.
Well, you have to remember that children of atheists are scientifically proven to be more intelligent.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know how to take that at first, Richard.
In the sense that they're more exposed to science, I suppose. But on the comment about it needing better editing and Dawkins going off on tangents, that's really just his style. If you read any of his books, he'll go on very detailed tangents about tangentially related things. And I don't think you could edit that out of Dawkins. It's just the way he writes. And it's not specifically a problem in this book. It's just his style of writing. And I enjoy his tangents, because the only problem I have with his tangents is finding where that idea was again when I want to go back.
Right, you know, you kind of lose track of the original thought. You know? It's kind of like he sees a shiny object over here. He's off on something else. And you're going, you know, I don't know, it just kind of has like a speed bump in your reading and kind of.
Maybe a childlike style.
What's that?
Maybe a childlike style. And that's the way children are. Objects.
On your point, though, is not only the way Dawkins has written, because he's written a lot, but if if you've ever seen him speak or watched him on, he's like got probably 1,000 different YouTube clips of Richard Dawkins out there. This reminded me a lot of listening to Dawkins talk.
I can hear him.
Yes.
He's read it in my head.
Absolutely.
I can absolutely hear him. And
I think that a lot of the structure of this book, because many of the methods of scientific storytelling that he uses, I've heard him speak about in other contexts. Mm-hmm. And so he's pulled all of these great stories and models that he's from, you know, many from previous books, but also probably from his extensive public speaking, and he's, you know, put them into book form. And so a lot of this probably comes from the fact that he's found this to be a very effective way to tell this particular story, and now he's committed it to writing. And one of the consequences of committing it to writing is that you can't necessarily see when he's in a public speaking situation how he was able to get from here to here and then back to where he's going. In the book, it's a little bit, you know, tangential and maybe kind of disconnected, where if you hear him in a lecture, oh yeah, it's a perfect way to round that out and bring us back to where you wanted us to be. I agree, because I've read so much of Dawkins that I could hear his voice as I was, you know, reading the book, and it's just...
I've watched him so much on YouTube's. I think there's something. I watch, if you're ever interested in looking at anything, look at topdocumentaries.com. You can find just about anything you ever want to watch on a documentary. And he has one where he's talking to a bunch of, I think they're probably would be senior, they're British children, so I think they're like seniors in high school. And he takes them off to look for fossils on a ocean. And it's quite interesting to see how the kids are really, a lot of them are very religious. Totally disregard what they're seeing, who they're with. I don't even know if they really realize. I mean, like, our kids would be like, "Whoa, Richard Dawkins," you know, and I mean, he's like a rock star, and you know, they're just kind of like oblivious to the whole thing. But it was just kind of interesting how he's trying to get them to think, and that was the whole part of it. It was just, you know, you have to break away from your mythological mindset and get outside of that and actually look. And that was really excellent how he was working with young people. That's why I thought maybe that inspired him to write a book like this.
Let's come back to the idea of videos and Dawkins, because I wanted to say something about that before we finish too, but go ahead.
Oh, it just sounds to me like it would be the type of book for a parent to have. So they have accurate information when those questions come up about the seasons. Yeah. You know, and it also has thought experiments that maybe you could, as a parent, dumb down, but you know, scale down for younger children. Mm. But I mean, at least you would have the accurate information and maybe understand the principle involved, so that you don't give them that the Earth is closer to the sun during the summer kind of information.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think parents are going to love this book. And I wonder if Dawkins' name is going to make it tainted in the minds of people who either are religious themselves or who are sympathetic to religion.
Duh.
That if you buy a book by Dawkins, somehow you're, you know, supporting the other side or something like
that. That's one of the things, one of the mothers on this Mothers Beyond Belief said she didn't like the Jesus myth in there. She didn't like that part, because it was like something else she had to explain to her kids. And she just didn't care for it. So she thought it should have been eliminated or whatever. I mean, people have their opinions.
I think if it were presented like along with other myths, I mean, and a kid would understand that it's a myth, you know.
Well, I can't think of any better way of explaining for the vast majority of children who've probably at least heard about Adam and Eve or something, that people don't come fully formed like that, you know?
Yeah.
Is there anyone else who's been waiting to get into the discussion as we wind up?
Yeah. Nick?
Just a comment on why this will indeed still be seen as a challenge to religion, and why Richard Dawkins' name on it will make it anathema to many people. You talk about optics and the beauty of understanding optics, but of course, understanding optics takes away from our cherished notions of the supernatural, for some people's, including such things as our special place in nature. I mean, to challenge any part of that takes away so much from so many people.
Yeah.
If I may, very quickly, I thought this is an excellent opportunity for me to mention something that's unexpected and unlikely opportunity to speak out on behalf of exactly what we're talking about. I have to go back 4 months. Did you, anybody notice that at the Dane County Fair last summer there was a creation booth?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've talked to them. We're going to have a scientific.
Yay! It's going to be right next to it.
I told them I don't want any confrontational. It's on the other side of the hall, but I mean, we're going to have, and I'll be enlisting people to be there. We're going to have a scientific explanation booth.
Great.
County Fair.
Count me in.
All right. I'll come back when you get.
So just to sort of wrap this up, the one thing that I speculate, and I can see this happening easily, is that Dawkins has written the books that he's written. He's delved into the issue of religion with the God delusion. He's obviously very big on evolution and you know, explaining natural selection as a powerful you know, explanation for why the world is the way it is. And now he's written a children's book. What's next for Dawkins? And my thought is, as I'm just kind of looking at the sweep of where Dawkins has come, is I think that, you know, Carl Sagan did Cosmos in 1980. And if you watch Cosmos today, you know, it's dated, but it's still so good and it's still so relevant. I believe, because Dawkins has done a lot of documentaries in the UK, he hasn't done so much on US TV for obvious reasons, because I think, again, his name is seen as too polarizing.
You can't watch it here in the United States.
But I would not be surprised to see Dawkins do something along the lines of a four-part series. Like Brian Greene is doing his thing on cosmology on Nova right now. I wouldn't be surprised if Dawkins is working on, or soon will be working on, something that might rival Cosmos.
Or the alternate universe type.
Yeah, a modern day great exposition of science for public television.
Well, this would be different because it maybe be more of the evolutionary thing, which is not, has not really been done. I was going to say that quote you had about the volcanoes and stuff that he put in there. He obviously hasn't been listening to any of the politicians. We're blaming all of those things on gay people.
Yeah. You were going to mention the YouTube or videos. Is that what you meant about documentaries, or did you mean something else?
No,
one last thing to say about
that. Yeah, I was going to come back to the idea that I believe Dawkins has more television video type documentaries in mind, and I have nothing to base that on except an epiphany that I had as I was reading this book. I can't believe that he wouldn't be thinking of something like that if he's not already. I've seen snatches, little bits and pieces of the documentaries that he did for whatever the UK equivalent of Nova is, the BBC, is some kind of science series or something like that. But he's got a couple that were very much out of the God delusion stage of his writing, and he's got others that are just great science documentaries. And so I think that he's probably going to come up with something along those lines. That, you know, he is the, as much as anybody, probably the best successor to the Carl Sagan, Stephen Jay Gould tradition of bringing popular science into the mainstream of, you know, the media in this country.
I think he's really excellent at presenting too.
He is.
I think he's better in his videos than sometimes in his debates he does. I think he's far better and more comfortable.
Yeah.
Because he's a professor, so he lends that element to it.
Yeah.
So. Well, thank you very much, John.
Thank you. Yes.